Welcome to the Geneva Peace Week podcast series, a project of the Geneva Peacebuilding Platform. Geneva Peace Week was founded on the core belief that each person, actor, and institution has a role to play in building peace and resolving conflict. Geneva Peace Week is an annual forum in the peacebuilding calendar that includes ceremonies, high-level panels, policy briefings, workshops, videos, podcasts, and other special events. These free contributions are hosted by different organizations and actors around the world. This year, Geneva Peace Week celebrates its 10th anniversary and is held from the 30th of October to the 3rd of November, 2023. For more content, join us at the Geneva Peace Week or online at www.genevapeaceweek.ch.
This is an excerpt from an episode of Frontline Negotiators, Stories from the Field, a podcast series produced by the Center of Competence on Humanitarian Negotiation. To listen to the full episode, find our series on all major podcasting platforms or visit frontline-negotiations.org. Let's now hear part of Priscilla Moyo's story. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, your story, and what motivated you to pursue a career in the humanitarian sector?
It's a bit of a weird path which I took. So I kind of fell into the role. It wasn't something that I was intentionally looking out for, but somehow providence and circumstances kind of led me to this. I originally had been working at home in South Africa in a local NGO, and a friend of mine persuaded me to apply for a job with an agency in Baghdad. I applied for it not confident that I was going to get the job because I had no experience at all in working outside of my home country context. By some miracle, I got the job. So that was my first experience in the humanitarian sector. And over the years, I've come in and out. So I tend to spend a few years doing humanitarian work, and then I go back to work at home at my local NGO. And then, so that's exactly how I started working as a humanitarian.
One of the tools that we often discuss, one of the tools that are available to humanitarian practitioners is called we call it the negotiation iceberg. It's very widely used among negotiators. And the idea is that there's always more underneath the surface when you're talking to a counterpart and beyond the position that they express, the reasoning that they share. There's always some digging that can be done into the real reasoning, the real motives that are driving their choices and their actions. So I was wondering if you could tell us perhaps about a story when you really had to dig deeper to better understand your counterparts.
My first mission was in Iraq, and I arrived in May 2014, and there had been elections. So I didn't get a lot of time to engage with my colleagues until soon after the elections. And then we had to go on our first mission. So it was also my first encounter with this particular camp that I was working in. And I had to introduce myself. And at the same time, there had been things that had been happening in the weeks prior to us resuming missions in this particular location. And we arrive at the camp and there's a protest by the residents right at the entrance of the checkpoint, and they're protesting and they're letting us know of their grievances. So once we had had an idea of what their grievances were, they told us that a fuel tankers had not been allowed into the camp for the past few weeks that we had not been visiting the camp. And that it was in the peak of summer and it was extremely hot. So the fact that there weren't any fuel tankers that had arrived, it meant that they had no air coolers that were functioning. Their containers that they were staying in were burning hot, and there was no cooling system at all, which made life quite difficult for them. It also made their ability to pump water quite tricky and quite challenging. So we proceeded to meet with the authorities who were responsible for the camp, and we we explained to them that the residents seemed to be complaining about the lack of fuel tanks coming into the camp. Could they help us to facilitate access for the fuel tankers to come in? And they explained to us that there were some security concerns in the whole of the country, so they had to really step up on their on their procedures for allowing tankers to come into the camp, because maybe those tankers might not be just bringing fuel. It could possibly be a bomb. All sorts of security reasons that they had informed us about the issue. So we continued to visit the camp, and at the end of the day, we went back. We went back to our office to discuss how we can tackle this issue. And a colleague of ours who had been working in the camp way longer than all of us had been, and I had been the one who had just been there for under a month, explained to us that there was a general idea from the camp authorities that the residents used to hoard or keep a lot of fuel reserves. So he was of the belief that they actually had enough fuel than they needed. So it took us sitting down and trying to understand our counterpart on how we can help him to move from his position. And my colleague recommended that the next time that we go into the camp, we should go and visit each and every site which allegedly housed these secret fuel storage places in the camp. So we did that. So the next time that we visited, we went around the camp, took pictures of every location where, you know, where the residents could purportedly have been keeping the fuel. We also spoke to the residents and tried to dig without making it seem like they are also hiding fuel, but trying to ask them that how many reserves do you have left right now? If there was no fuel coming in for the next month, how would you cope? What would you do? And getting all this information from them so that when we go back to the authorities, we can try and allay his concerns or his views of what the issue was. So we did all that. We spoke to the residents, we took pictures of those sites without trying to also out the residents, you know, kind of like, so you're caught in between two spots that maybe they hoard fuel because sometimes they have instances like this when the authorities block fuel. So you want them to be able to do whatever coping mechanism without outing them that much. So we went back to the authorities and we explained to them that we had gone around the camp. We had looked everywhere and we saw that there weren't enough fuel reserves. So if he would be amenable to just allowing this one tank to come in and to just relieve the pressure and the stress that the camp residents were having, we would be happy to follow up and to actually even escort the tanker if it needed us to escort it, to make sure that it really just was fuel. So we proposed this, and in the end, he didn't raise the security issue anymore. So it seemed as though we had touched on the thing that really was his main reason for not allowing the tanker. And in the end, he allowed that one tanker to come in. But for the rest of the month, it's not one of those happy stories where I can say there was a fuel tanker that came in every other day as it had previously done. But he only allowed two fuel tankers to come in that entire month and the preceding months until things settled down and then things resumed to normal. But that was already only in August by then. So there were 2 months of this back and forth. Of trying to negotiate with the counterpart and trying to appeal to his underlying reasons and his concerns. So I think that's the best example that I have.
Thank you for sharing. I'm just curious to know. So when you find yourself in such a situation and you need to prepare, with your team to go talk to the counterpart. Is there any approach that you use? How do you get ready for the negotiation process?
I was still new, so I can't pretend as if I had all my, I had everything prepared. And to be honest, if it wasn't for the fact that we benefited from having a team member who had been there previously and had more experience than we would, we'd have made so many mistakes. But now, as a practice, what I've learned from that previous experience and from some of the tools that I've gained through CCCHN is the importance of actually sitting down as a team prior to a negotiation, getting to know your counterpart as well as you can, getting to know, you know, kind of like his position and what his values and his motives are. So now I make quite frequent use of, there's a checklist that CCCHN provides for those who deal with the iceberg tool. And that has become so helpful for us as a team to sit down and to brainstorm on possible scenarios and possible reasonings that the counterpart has. And it's super, super helpful. At least it means that we go into the negotiation not completely blind or unprepared, but we have possible scenarios of how the negotiation could go in the best case scenario and in the worst case scenario, and how we can try and keep to trying to get the compromise that will help us with our goals. So I actually firmly believe in teams getting to, I think a lot of the negotiation really is about teams getting together and preparing well in advance and working together as a team. So it makes a huge difference on how the negotiation goes.
You were telling me just before about how different it is when you're a national in the country you're working with, because you really have a lot of background information about the social and political context that team members might not have. Yeah. So how do you compose your negotiation team?
I think it's a very interesting question, because I think, Barbara, some of it is that it's not so much within the control of you know, kind of like all of us are our staff within an organization. So somehow, sometimes you end up you being grouped together, people of coming from different backgrounds with different personality traits and with different dispositions. So what I've learned as time has gone by is it's so important to have a team where we complement one another in terms of our skills, but something that we often maybe underestimate or underlook is also in terms of personality and disposition. So some people are very good at confronting issues head on and tackling the more difficult conversations very easily. And then you also have the diplomatic people who are more subtle in how they approach things. And then you have people who are a lot more emotional.
The other thing that you mentioned that I thought was really interesting is having to deal with counterparts that might be particularly aggressive or nervous. And you mentioned the need to sometimes de-escalate the situations that are really, really tense. How do you go about it? I'm curious to know. Do you have a specific technique or approach that helps you manage people that are feeling particularly tense?
In this particular context, for once, I will be very honest and be transparent. That I use the race and the language and the expat card quite well in these kind of situations. So I am very quick to, when I see that the situation is escalating, I am very quick to kind of say, please forgive me. You know, I come from Africa and and I'm not aware of the context. I didn't mean to disrespect you. And everything that I spoke is coming from a good place. You know, so it's very easy for me to do that, to say, forgive me, you can see that I'm not from here, or that I'm not familiar with, you know, the background between the counterpart and the people we are negotiating on behalf. So I use that to my advantage, to kind of be neutral and at the same time to calm the situation down. But I do it in a not in a funny way, because I guess in some instances it's not appropriate to be completely funny, but I actually then completely lower myself. So I don't hesitate to do that and say, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, you have to forgive me where I come from. This is, you know, this is so normal. Can we start afresh? So then he then says, okay, you're a foreigner. You are female. You are, you know, so I will excuse you this time. So when I build rapport with the counterpart, with time, they would sometimes, I was very fortunate that in this instance, it was a long step. We had to work together for a whole 2 years. So towards the end, he would say, no, Priscilla, you can't use the excuse that you are foreign and you're from Africa anymore. We've been together for a year, so you should know better. So he would use that as well now to kind of soften instances where maybe we might feel offended, and he would say, no, you are now part of us in the camp. You now know us very well. So this is how we can do things, and it would de-escalate the situation.
You've been listening to Priscilla Mojo, part of the Frontline Negotiators Stories from the Field podcast series.
You've been listening to the Geneva Peace Week podcast series. For more content like this, join us at the Geneva Peace Week or online at www.genevapeaceweek.ch.